Welcome, listeners, to the City of Angels, where the sun burns bright and the shadows run deeper. You're tuned into Dragnet Recovered Files, a retrospective dive into the cases that shaped the badge. These are real cases of old. Each episode, we dust off a relic from the golden age of radio crime drama, featuring Sergeant Joe Friday, the relentless detective who chased justice with a notebook in one hand and a city's secrets in the other. So pour yourself a hot brew, switch off the lights, and step into a time where truth echoed in mono and every beat had a body behind it. Tonight's recovered case files are Police Academy, August 25th, 1949. A cadet dies under suspicious circumstances inside the LAPD training grounds. Was it an accident or something darker festering behind the drills and discipline? Myra the Redhead, September 1st, 1949. Over 250 car burglaries hit Los Angeles in a wave of crime, and all signs point to a fiery-haired mastermind pulling the strings. But can Friday break the gang before the city loses control? And our last episode is Eric Kelby, September 3rd, 1949. A wife vanishes without a trace. Her husband says she's fine, but the detectives think otherwise. What they find is a chilling truth, buried under nursery wallpaper and sealed lips. These are the stories. The files are real. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent. Legends, enjoy your heavily remastered, recovered, and repaired Golden Time Radio.
Detective Sergeant, you're assigned to robbery detail. An armed gang of blitz bandits has started to work in your city. Their pace is fast, 4 and 5 robberies each night. The criminals are not amateurs. They're well armed, dangerous. Your job, get them.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime, investigated and solved by the men who unrelentingly stand watch on the security of your home, your family, and your life. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Thursday, October 23rd. It was windy in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of robbery. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on my way back from the statistician's office, and it was 11:42 a.m. when I got to room 27A. Robbery detail.
How'd it work out, Joe? Any good prospects?
Well, I don't know how good they are, but I got a handful.
How many did you get?
Well, let me see. 15, 18, 22. Ethel down in the stats office ran them on the IBM for me. There they are.
I see.
It's a gang of 3 men working on foot. Blitz robberies. They only take cash. M.O. is tie-ups. Work from 8 to 10 at night. One of the gang's tall, the other 2 short.
And these are the men the machine's ordered out.
Under that heading, yeah. If our information's wrong, then so is the machine.
Got a good bunch of candidates here. Descriptions match up with what we got.
They seem to. Check the names on that list, Ben. Some of the smartest thieves in the country.
Yeah. Tommy Willis, Ray Grepper, Kemp Sotelli, Manny Roberts, George Cross, Mario Koski. Reads like June graduation at San Quentin.
Yeah, George Cross and Tommy Willis are in town, we know that.
And Koski, he's around a couple of weeks ago.
And what about the rest? It's a big field.
Have to check them out, I guess. Might as well start at the beginning.
Did you go through the overnight reports yet?
Yeah, no restaurants, no liquor stores. That makes 5 days the gang's laid off.
They can afford to, can't they? 18 robberies in 24 days, that's a pretty good haul.
This stop-and-go strategy of theirs, Joe, it's got me.
Yeah. They work hard for a week in one area, and then they lay low. If they just keep going, we might have a better try at them.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah, Chandler.
Fell out here to see you, Joe. Name's Decker.
Decker? Henry Decker?
Didn't say. Want to see him?
Yeah, send him in.
Right. All right, Mr. Decker. This way.
How are you, Joe? You're looking good.
Oh, Hank Decker. How are you?
I'm fine.
Well, what are you waiting for? Applause? Come on in and shut the door. Hank, this is my partner, Ben Romero. Ben, Hank Decker.
Hi, Hank.
Hi, Ben.
Hank and I are in service together.
Yeah, I just dropped in for a visit, Joe. Are you busy?
No more than usual. Sit down.
Thanks. I remembered you telling me you were on the PD, so I figured I'd drop around and get an inside track.
How do you mean?
I just filed with Civil Service to take the exam next month. Figure I'd like to work at being a cop.
You shell shot, Joe.
Great pep talk you boys hand out.
You sure you want to be a cop?
Oh, look, I'm 30 years old, Joe. I'm married, high school education, about a year of junior college.
What's your wife think?
She's not sold. Well, that's why I dropped in. How about coming out to the house for dinner tonight?
You want me to sell her?
Just talk to her. Seven okay?
Yeah, seven's okay.
All right. I'm glad to have met you, Ben.
Come here, Decker. See you again.
All right. Bye, Joe.
See you tonight, Hank. Well, what do you think, Ben?
Ought to make a good cop.
We had a list of 22 possible suspects. By 5 o'clock, Ben and I had checked out two of them who might possibly have had a hand in the blitz robberies of the 18 liquor stores and restaurants in the past 24 days. Number one man was Thomas Willis, Caucasian, age 29, 5 feet 11 inches, 175 pounds, dark hair, blue eyes. Number two man was Mario Koski, Caucasian, 5 feet 6 inches, 170 pounds, dark hair, dark eyes, large scar under his chin, running across his throat, up to and behind his left ear. According to our informants, and after questioning some of their associates, either Willis or Koski or both could have taken part in the blitz holdups. We showed their mugs to the victims, but none of them could give us definite assurance that either Willis or Koski were in the holdup gang. At 7 that night, I went out to Hank Decker's house for supper, met his wife, Linda, his 4-year-old twin boys. We talked about the army, played with the kids for a while. Before we sat down to eat, we put the boys in bed. Hank was in the kitchen carving a roast. His wife closed the door to the kids' room, and we started downstairs for the kitchen.
What do you think of our two atom bombs?
Fine kids, Miss Decker. Hank told me that you were worried about him wanting to join the force.
I was 12 years old when my father was shot down. He was a policeman in Des Moines. He was only 37 when he died. I wouldn't know what to do if anything like that happened to Hank.
What do you want me to say?
But does Hank really want it? Can't you talk him out of it?
You're his wife. Can you? No, I think it's his choice, Miss Decker. He's going to have to make up his own mind.
I'm sorry. It's what Hank wants. I guess I worry too much.
A lot of women marry cops. They have, and they will, and they all worry. Hank will be all right.
Will you guarantee it, Joe?
During the next month, I heard from Hank Decker only once. He was studying hard. During the same month, Ben and I were working hard, trying to find some kind of a concrete lead to break the Blitz gang. There had been no subsequent holdups which seemed to tie in directly with the gang or its operations. From the list of possible suspects which Ben and I made up, 18 names had been eliminated for one reason or another. Either they were in jail at the time of the robberies, out of the Los Angeles area, or out of the state. But 4 names remained: George Cross, Tommy Willis, Mario Koski, Julian Brock. During the latter part of the month, George Cross was booked on a minor charge, and we questioned him at that time. He showed no knowledge of the holdups. Nearly 2 months after the robberies were committed, Ben and I were still without a solution as to the whereabouts of the gang.
Never known a Blitz gang back this way before, Joe. Once they get wound up, they usually go until they're caught.
Yeah. Did you get out those telegram checks to the east yet?
Last night before I went home. Sent out all 3.
Willis, Koski, and Brock. I'd like to find just one of them.
Chicago might have something. That's Koski's old hangout. Willis, too.
What about Brock? He's from Kansas City, isn't he?
Yeah. I got a wire, too. Might have an answer from one of them tomorrow.
That's a slow job. We'll have to wait it out.
Guess so. No follow-up from the victims we talked to.
I'll get it. Robbery Friday.
Oh, hiya, Joe. Hank Decker, congratulate me.
What for?
I just passed my written exam. Got the letter this morning. How about that?
That's fine. When do you take your physical?
Oh, not till the end of the month. Next week, I agility tests, then the physical. If I get by them, I'm in.
Well, you're going to have a full month at the police academy after the test. There's a lot of work, Hank.
Oh, it can't be any worse than these tests.
It's a tough 30 days out there on the hill. Law, court procedure, evidence, combat fighting, target practice. You'll have to wade through all of them.
You ever going to have anything encouraging to say?
Yeah, when you graduate.
I won't count on it. How's the job going?
Slow. How's your wife feel now?
About taking the job?
Mm-hmm.
A little better. She said to say hello.
Okay. Keep us posted, huh?
I'll do that, Joe.
Right. Bye. Hank passed his written test.
Sure anxious.
Brandy, Romero, got a minute?
Yes, Skipper. Come on, Joe.
You got something, Ed?
Yeah, those bitch robberies you're handling. Not having much luck.
We were. Gang's disappeared. Not a trace of them so far.
They leave town?
Oh, we're not sure, Ed. We don't even have a good description. We're guessing most of the way.
What are your guesses? You've had a couple of months to make them.
12 of the holdup victims we talked to told us definitely that there were 3 men in the gang. 2 of them short, 1 of them tall. We've just been working from there.
All 3 of them have dark complexions. Started with 22 possibilities and got it weeded down to 4. No, wait a minute, 3.
Yeah. Tommy Willis, Mario Koski, Julian Brock. Willis and Koski are Eastern Hoods. Brock's from the Middle West.
And where are they now?
Haven't showed their faces around town. Checking some of the cities in the East. That's about all we got, Skipper.
Not much for 2 months' work. Thieves can't be that smart.
Right now they are.
We've sounded out every lead we had, Ed. We're doing our best.
Either of you ever hear of a man by the name of Al Mishikov?
No, I don't think so.
Chicago gunman in the old days, wasn't he, Ed?
That's right.
I thought he was doing time in Joliet.
Paroled last year. Got a tip he was spotted on East Broadway night before last.
You figure it might tie in with our job?
I don't know. Find out. If I remember right, Mishikov's brother used to be pretty friendly with Mario Koski. I helped send both of them up 13 years ago. Same rap. Robbery.
Is that all you heard, Ed? Somebody spotted Mishikov?
That's all. If you can track him down, you might get some kind of a lead. That's more than you got now.
That night and for the next 2 nights following, Ben and I had dinner downtown instead of going home, and then we spent the rest of the night covering the lower end of the city in search of Al Mishikov. We got more than a dozen leads on where to find him from some of our informants, but none of the leads paid off. We kept missing him. No one knew where he was staying. No one knew, or no one would tell us.
Worst thing about this job, Joe, legwork.
You must be averaging 10 miles a night.
My feet say 20. Almost midnight.
Here's McCarthy's place. Let's try it.
Right.
Let's go down to the end of the bar, Ben.
Yeah.
Hiya, Ben. Good to see you come in.
What's new? Oh, not much, Bert. Meet my partner, Joe Friday.
Hiya, Friday. What do you fellas have?
Looking for a guy, Bert. His name's Al Mishikov, Chicago. You heard anything?
He was in here earlier tonight. Couple of guys with him.
Are you sure? What do you look like?
6 feet, about 45, I guess. Big build.
Sounds like him, all right, Joe. Is he staying in the neighborhood, Bert?
Down here? I don't think so. Most of those big timers stay uptown someplace. You looking for Mishikov?
I'd like to talk to him. How long ago was he in?
About 8 o'clock. A couple of guys with him. They were talking about driving out to the airport. Something about Las Vegas.
There's an 840 plane for Vegas, isn't there, Ben?
I think so. 840, 850. I can't recall which.
Bert, do you remember the exact time they left?
Exactly. No. Say, there's one of the fellas that was with Mishikov down there in the middle of the bar.
Which one, Bert?
Yeah, one with the sandy hair, big chin. See him?
Yeah. Want to talk to him?
Come on.
Josh, you know what he said? He said when he was in Vegas last week.
Pardon me.
Killing, yeah, that's
where. Pardon me. I'd like to talk to you a minute.
Yeah, who are you?
Police, Sergeant Friday.
Oh, have a drink, Sergeant.
No, thanks. I said I wanted to talk to you.
Square John. Wait a minute, George. Square John wants to talk to me.
Come on outside. We can talk better out there.
I ain't done nothing. What's the pitch? I got a right to know.
Let's go outside.
Maybe I don't want to go outside.
I think you better. Come on.
All right, quit shoving, you dumb cop, shoving people around. What are you trying to do? Sausage.
All right, down this way.
Car's parked up the next alley, Joe.
Hey, look, what's this all about, huh? I got a right to know.
You were seen with Al Mishikov tonight. Where is he?
Who?
Al Mishikov. You want us to spell it?
I don't think you can spell your own name.
Nobody's asking you to play smart. Where's Mishikov?
Out of town. What do you care?
Here's the car. All right, inside you.
No. Look, you got me wrong. I ain't done nothing.
Where's Mishikov?
You and some other guy drove to the airport with him tonight. Let's have him.
I'm clear, I tell you. I just drove out with him, that's all.
Where'd Mishikov go?
Vegas. Took the plane for Vegas.
When?
About 8:30, 8:45. What's up, anyway?
Who's the guy traveling with Mishikov?
Nobody.
Who's the guy traveling with Mishikov?
Kosky. I just met him tonight.
Mario Kosky, is that the guy?
Yeah, I'm level and I ain't done nothing.
Ben, get to a phone, call the office, contact Las Vegas police, ask them to pick up Kosky and Mishikov. When we got back to the office, we questioned the man we had picked up for almost 2 hours. His name was John Delmar, an ex-convict. He'd been paroled from Folsom Prison 2 months before after serving 3.5 years for burglary. He said Mishikov was looking for a man to work with him and Kosky. He didn't specify the work. Delmar said he refused the offer, but they parted on friendly terms. He said Kosky and Mishikov told him that they were going to Las Vegas for a few days, then returned to Los Angeles. But when Ben and I checked back with the Las Vegas police the next morning, they reported that nobody answering the description of either Kosky or Mishikov was seen arriving or leaving the airport. We checked with the airlines and sent inquiries to law enforcement agencies throughout the entire area. No sign. 3 weeks went by. Still, no sign.
Nothing in the overnights, Joe. No, not a thing.
Oh, yeah, same here. Reno, Sacramento, San Francisco. Nobody's seen him.
Ain't got to come out sometime. We can wait.
Yeah, we can wait. Gets on your nerves. Let's check with Backstrand. Maybe he's got a job for us in the meantime.
You're getting as eager as your friend Hank Decker, Joe. Incidentally, how'd things turn out for him?
He passed all his exams, putting in his month's training at the academy now. He should do all right.
Hiya.
Hiya, Mike. Skipper busy?
Not in his office. Won't be until afternoon.
What's the matter?
Got a lecture at the police academy this morning.
Thanks, Mike. Come on, Ben. Ben and I drove out to the police academy near Elysian Park. We went out to check with Ed Backstrand on the Blitz robberies, not to listen to his lecture. When we walked into the classroom, he was just finishing up, so we sat in the back of the room and listened. It was a pretty good speech.
Because of the alertness of the arresting officer, his talent for memorizing detail, and his knowledge of how a criminal acts under a given set of circumstances, the arrest was made. Well, that's about it, gentlemen. Thank you for your attention. Now, when I ran this speech over at home, my wife said it wasn't a very good talk, but at least it came out on time. Now, it seems, I'm 2 minutes short, so I guess I failed on both counts. If I may, I'd like to use the few minutes that are left to tell you what I think of being a cop after 24 years. For one reason or other, you men have chosen the career of a police officer. Well, let me tell you right now, without any qualifications, it's a thankless job. Maybe you can't see it now. Maybe you think I'm exaggerating. But when you graduate next week and get that uniform on, your whole lives are going to change. You're going to lose friends, a lot of them. They'll want parking tickets fixed, some other favors. You'll have to turn them down, so you'll be a heel, a fathead. When you're on the beach, you're going to meet the cream of society and the scum, the lowest. Sometimes you won't be able to tell the difference. Some of you will have to work with thugs, stupid gangsters, dope addicts, cheap women. All the human garbage you can find in a big city. You'll come home at night and take a shower to wash off the dirt, but you still won't feel clean. That's the job. And you buy a box of candy and bring it home for your anniversary, the neighbors will say you chiseled it. When you save up a few dollars and buy a new car or some furniture for the house, it's graft. People are going to want favors. They'll offer you things, a free beer or a new dress for your wife. If you take it, you're a chiseler. If you don't, you're a tough cop. Well, here's a piece of advice. Take nothing from anyone, no matter how good a friend he is. Pay for everything you get and don't ask favors. Treat everybody alike, no matter what they look like or what they believe in. You don't play favorites. There are going to be times when a few men in the department get out of line. The newspapers will play it up because it makes good reading and the average John public will love it. Because that's the only way he can pay you back for that traffic ticket you gave him. Being a good cop is a hard job, but it's a good one. Let me warn you just once more. It's one of the most thankless jobs on earth. That's all, gentlemen.
The following week, Hank Decker graduated from the police academy and hit the transfer list for a regular assignment. He drew a job of teaching combat firing and boxing at the academy. He didn't like it, so he put in a request for a transfer and waited. For the next 6 weeks, Ben and I waited, too, for some sign of the Blitz bandits. There wasn't any. The only possible suspects, Mario Kosky and Al Mishikov, had disappeared completely. We kept a close check on every possible avenue of information. Still, No sign. Ben and I were transferred to the night watch on robbery for a few weeks, and that gave Hank Decker a chance to drop in and visit with us a couple of hours when he went off duty at the academy. He was still as eager as ever.
Hi, Ben. Joe, anything new?
Hi, Hank. Nothing here. What about the academy?
Oh, big news.
What's up?
Getting a transfer starting next Monday. Gonna start on a beat.
Thought you were all tied up with that boys' club you started out there.
Oh, I was, but Hanson's gonna take over when I leave. Ah, the kids sure love it. Free swimming in the pool, boxing lessons. We teach them everything.
Where's your beat gonna be, huh?
Central, right in the downtown district. Might learn something, huh?
You'll learn a lot. You'll want to forget most of it.
Look, it's a quarter after seven. Don't you ever go home for dinner, Hank?
Oh, getting a wife used to it. This new shift's gonna be night work, you know.
Wait till you're on it for a year, and then you tell us how you like it.
A year? I want to be in the detective bureau after a year.
Well, you're not even going to last a year if you don't get home to dinner. Your wife's called twice this week already. She calls me.
Okay, when did she call tonight?
She hasn't, Jim.
I guess I better head her off. Let me know if anything breaks, huh, Joe? I'd like to tag along.
Okay, Hank. Well, on your way.
Okay, good night.
So long.
Good night. How eager can you get?
Were we like that when we started?
Not me. I never had that much energy at one time in my whole life. Hot shot, Joe.
I'll get it.
At 767 East Broadway, a liquor store, 211 and Sluggig. At 767 East Broadway, a liquor store, 211 and...
767 East Broadway, 211, liquor store.
Let's go.
East Broadway, King's Liquor Store. We pushed our way through the small crowd outside the door and into the shop. Two patrolmen in uniform were already interviewing the proprietor. He had two large gashes on his head just above the right temple. He was trembling and badly shaken, but he managed to give us a good description of the holdup men.
Yeah, I can tell you what they looked like. Three of them. One short, one tall, husky, another short, fat.
You remember what they were wearing?
Their coats. All three, dark coats. One of the short men, he had a big scar here on the throat, like this. After the three men robbed the store, they slugged me and tied me up.
Turner, this man's hurt. You call an ambulance?
On the way, Sergeant.
That's fine. We have just one more question, Mr. King. Here's a handful of pictures. We'd like you to tell us if any one of these men were in the gang that held you up tonight.
Let me look.
There you are. Take your time.
No. No, not him. No. 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 Oh, this one. Here. He took the money from the register.
Would you look through the rest, please? Are there any more?
Let me see again. No. No. Oh, here. Another one. There's a fat one with the scar. This is him. I think he's the one that slugged me.
Thanks, Mr. King. Here's our card. We'll be contacting you later. Turner, will you and your partner take the crime report? We've got some checking to do.
Right, Sergeant.
Thanks. Come on, Ben.
Yeah. Kosky and Mishikov. You picked out both of them, Joe.
Yeah, certainly did, didn't we?
Attention, all units. Attention, all units.
Wait a minute.
The southeast corner of Broadway and East 3rd, a liquor store and restaurant, 211, vote 3. All units. The southeast corner of
Come
Broadway.
Come on, Ben, let's roll. When we got to the liquor store and restaurant at Broadway and East 3rd, Ben and I knew for certain that Kosky and Mishikov were back in the city and working hard. Their M.O. matched down to almost the smallest detail. We put a call through to communications, and the entire central division was alerted. Then we called Chief Backstrand and told him the news. He assigned a special detail from the Metropolitan Unit to patrol the area until further notice. But at 9:23 p.m., before they pulled out of the police garage, the Blitz Bandits added two more liquor stores and one more restaurant to their list of victims. Early the next morning, Ben and I met with Chief Backstrand in his office.
You got a make on that third man yet?
We ran his description through R&I early this morning, Ed. Closest candidate's a guy by the name of Julian Brock. Done time here in New York.
Any tie-up with Kosky or Mishikov?
Mama Sheet says he knows Kosky pretty well.
And that's good enough. Now, how do you think you're going to get these thieves?
We've got the alert out, Chief. Special detail from Metropolitan Division's been brief. Communications all set.
All right. Here's a tip for you. Tell the men if there's a hold-up call that only the car in the area of the hold-up will handle it. These thieves are no amateurs. Let me try some decoy trick. Tell the men to stay in the area they're assigned to until they receive a call. Check?
We'll take care of it, Ed. You going to be on hand tonight?
And when do you figure on starting?
We'll have the full detail out for 6:30.
Play it safe and start at 4. Why chance missing him?
At At 3:30 that afternoon, we left the police garage with a special detail from Metropolitan Division and we started to cruise the central area. We weren't looking for any action the first few hours, and we didn't get any. The 5 o'clock traffic in the downtown area was heavy as usual.
Hope that gang holds off till after 6. We couldn't get out of this traffic if our lives depended on it.
Well, we'd probably do better on foot if it wasn't for radio contact.
Control 4 to 80K. Control 4 to 80K, your location.
Get it, will you, Joe?
Yeah, wait till I get the mic. 80K to Control 4. 80K to Control 4. Our location on Spring Street between 2nd and 3rd.
80K, stand by. 80K, call your office code 2. Call your office code 2, KMA
367. 80K to Control 4, Roger, KMA 367.
Yeah, now what do I do for a parking space?
You know, you're lucky. That guy up ahead there, he's pulling out.
Good, that hasn't happened to me in 6 months.
Okay, hold on, Ben. I'll be back in a minute.
Yeah.
Robbery, Chandler.
This Friday, Bill. You want us?
Yeah, just a minute, Joe. Chief wants to talk to you. Hello, Friday.
Yeah, Ed.
Cruiser car just brought in a guy answering the description of Mario Koski.
Yeah?
Get over here right away and question the guy. If it is Koski, we can all go home early.
Ben and I went back to the office and questioned the man who gave his name as Conrad Larkin. It was Koski's approximate height and weight, same color hair, same color eyes. The resemblance to Koski's picture was evident. We questioned him thoroughly about the Blitz robberies, and then we checked out his fingerprints. The coincidence was hard to overlook, but we were satisfied. The man was not Mario Koski. There was a phone message on my desk to call Hank's wife. I called her, and then we checked with Chief Backstrand again and started for the police garage. It was 6:10.
Ben, Joe, wait a minute, will you?
Oh, hi, Hank. What's all the excitement?
Heard about those jobs last night, the Blitz gang. How about tagging along tonight?
What's the stare?
Well, suit yourself, Hank. Plenty I do home for dinner.
I told the wife I'd eat out tonight.
You sure you're not due home for dinner?
No, not tonight, Joe. Did you have any luck yet?
Not so far, Hank. Maybe later on tonight.
Come on, here's the garage.
How close did you come to the gang last night?
Not close enough. 2 steps ahead of us all the way.
They sure must work fast. 5 jobs in a row.
All right, Hank, let's don't rub it in, huh? Hey, Ben, watch it, will you?
Yeah. Woman driver.
How about it, Joe? You think I can make you up?
You talk to Ed Backstrand, he might get you a transfer after a while.
Yeah, I might try it. Joe, look across the street. There's a guy coming out of the bar.
Where?
In front of the bar. He's standing there. Guy in the dark coat, you see?
Yeah. 2 other guys behind him.
Who is it?
I can't be sure. Ben, you better pull up.
That's it's just like his picture.
All right. Come on. All right, hold it, mister. We want to talk to you.
Run for it, Al Copper!
Watch it, Joe!
Hank, get down. Get down!
2 of them down, Ben.
Other one up alley.
Let's go. Did they get Hank?
Yeah.
All right, hold it right here. All right, Husky. Throw out your gun and come out with your hands up. All right, let's return the fire. Come on.
He had his chance.
Yeah. Grab his gun. Let's get back to Hank. Mm-hmm. Did you get the guns from the other 2?
Yeah, they're dead. Hank got them both.
All right, one side, please. Officer, did you call an ambulance?
Yeah, they're on their way.
Come on, Ben. One side, please. Will you let us through? Hank, how you doing?
That's a good job.
Ben, will you get the crowd black? Give him some air.
Would you just move back?
All right, easy, Hank. I'll be here in a minute. Hank? Hank?
How's it going, Joe? Gone?
Yeah, come on.
What have you got, Joe?
Phone message from Hank's wife.
For you?
Yeah.
You returned the call?
Before we left the office.
What was it?
She wanted me to remind Hank. He was due home for dinner at 7 o'clock.
The story you have just heard is true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
In 3 months, more than 250 cars have been broken into. Property mounting well into thousands of dollars has been stolen. 2 youthful members of the gang have been apprehended. The all-important brains of the criminal ring, the leaders, are still at large. Your job, get them.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime, investigated and solved by the men who unrelentingly stand watch on the security of your home, your family, and your life. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Monday, March 2nd. It was cold in Los Angeles. We were working the night shift out of auto theft. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on the way back from the interrogation room, and it was 10:58 p.m. when I got to room 26, chief of detectives' office.
Real tough kids, aren't they?
Yeah, they won't admit a thing.
Now sit down.
Thanks.
When'd you pick him up?
About 8:30 tonight in the parking lot behind the Star Theater out on Sunset. He was lifting the radio out of a 48 convertible. He's had lots of experience.
Report says you picked up a 19-year-old girl with him.
She was waiting for the guy in a parked car across the street from the theater. Car was full of loot.
The first real break we've had on those auto burglaries in 3 months, and it's no good to us.
Neither one of them will talk. They won't even admit they know each other.
You run makes on them?
Just did. We've been questioning the boy for an hour, getting nowhere.
What's his name again?
Freeman. Stanley Freeman.
Age 20. Address? Butte, Montana. Down here for a vacation.
He doesn't lie very well, Ed. He's never been to Butte, Montana in his life. Knows less about the town than I do.
Well, get to him.
Right, Ed.
Where'd you put the girl?
We had a policewoman take her to our office. We can talk to her when we finish with the boy.
Well, what's her story?
Hasn't any. She won't even open her mouth.
19 years old. Probably needs a good spanking. Now get him to talk.
Right.
Run a make, Joe?
Yeah, he's clean.
Get wise, huh, Flatfoot?
Look, you're in a bad spot, son. That kind of talk isn't going to help.
Says you.
We caught you red-handed trying to steal a radio that didn't belong to you from a car it didn't belong to you. Is that right?
That's enough to send you to San Quentin, boy. You better give us the story.
Shut up.
We got all the evidence we need for him.
Maybe you don't realize how serious this is. We've had more than 250 car burglaries in this city in the past 3 months. Over $200,000 worth of property has been stolen. That's a lot of money.
So what?
So you're the number one suspect, young fellow. Your method of operation in breaking into that car tonight is the same used in most of the other burglaries. It means you're not going to be tried just for this job tonight.
What are you getting at, Flatfoot?
Listen, son. In the state of California, breaking into a locked car is a felony. You can go to state penitentiary for that. And we're going to file a complaint of burglary with the district attorney in the morning.
You say you're from Butte, Montana. All right, I don't believe you, but we'll make sure. Ben, go down to our office and call the news photographers. Stanley here is going to have his picture on the front page of every newspaper in Los Angeles tomorrow.
Right, Joe.
No, you can't. I won't let you. I got my rights.
What's the matter, youngster? Everybody wants his picture in the paper.
Yeah, well, I don't. I won't let him.
We got your picture already, Freeman, remember? They took it when they fingerprinted you.
You can't use it. You can't. I'll get a lawyer.
Reporters will be over in a couple of minutes. We have to give them your story and your picture, too. This one.
You won't. You won't. Give it
all
to me.
All right, all right.
Give it to
all
me.
All right, Freeman, get your hands off him. Now sit down.
All right. Now let's have it straight.
Don't let him use the picture. Don't let him. You can't. You can't.
We gotta have the truth, son. Now, look, you're 20 years old. You know right from wrong. You'll have to take your medicine. If you cooperate, we'll do all we can to help.
I live out in the Wilshire District. All I wanted was a little extra money. We didn't take much. We didn't think it was so wrong.
It was stealing, Freeman. You know that's wrong. Where do you live out there?
Piper Avenue. 821 Piper. You won't give him my picture.
You live there with your family?
Yeah, my mother. Father's dead. Promise me you won't give him the picture. My mother, she'd see it. Promise me.
You're working with a gang on those auto burglaries. We know that. Now, who are they, where are they, and what's the setup?
I can't. They get me for it.
Who'd get you?
I can't tell you. I can't.
Who's your girlfriend, Stanley, the one you're with tonight?
Joanne. Joanne Miller.
Where does she live?
Piper Avenue, same as me. Lives on the same block, 866.
At her home? You live there with her folk?
Yeah. Mother and father. They work.
And you got her into this. Isn't that the story she gave us, Ben?
I did not. I didn't. It was her. She said a bunch of kids were doing it. It was quick money, something to do at night. She started it.
All right, Romero. I'll go see the girl. You stay here with Freeman.
Right, Joe. Just stay put in that chair for him.
Hi, Marge.
Hello, Joe. You and Romero handling this case?
Yeah. I'd like to talk to the girl a few minutes, Marge. Would you stand by?
Right, I'll sit over here.
Thanks. All right, miss, what's your name, age, and address?
I told this lady cop 15 minutes ago I'm not saying anything.
All right, then we'll tell you. Your name's Joanne Miller. You live at 866 Piper Avenue. You live with your father and mother. Both of them work.
You're a liar. That's not me.
You're 19 years old. You live on the same block as your boyfriend, Stanley Freeman, and you're the one who got him mixed up in this gang. Isn't that right?
No, it's not right. It's not. I didn't do anything.
Well, that's only half the story. Freeman told us everything. You want to hear the rest?
No. Stan wouldn't tell you. He wouldn't.
He told us how you got him mixed up in it. Quick money. That's what you told him, didn't you?
No, it was him. I can prove it. The rest of the kids will tell you. He got me in this. Ask them, they'll tell you. It was Stanley and Fred Milford and George Jansen. They started it, all three of them.
All right. Will you tell the story to a police stenographer?
I'll tell him everything. He's not blaming this on me.
Marge, will you go get the stenographer?
Right.
Now, how many persons in this gang of yours?
Oh, about 10 or 12. And it's not my gang either. He got me into this, and now he's trying to lie his way out, blaming me.
How long have you been doing this, burglarizing cars?
Me? Oh, only about 2 weeks. It was supposed to be fun, something to do at night. The rest of them been at it a couple of months.
Who's the head of the gang?
I told you, it's him, Stanley, and Fred Milford and Jansen, all three. I only started going out with him 2 weeks ago, maybe less.
All right, Joanne. Tell it to the stenographer the same way.
The stenographer will be in a minute, Joe.
Okay, Marge, thanks. Stay with her.
Right, Joe.
Just about a closed case, Ben. The girl gave us a full confession.
She didn't. Oh, you're not tricking me again. She didn't.
She told us you're one of the leaders of the gang, Stanley. Said you got her into all this. The other two are George Jansen and Fred Milford. About a dozen kids in the gang, all of them about your age. Isn't that right?
She's lying, can't you tell? She's lying. She got me into the gang. Well, she did. She's Milford's girlfriend. Ask her. Oh, she can't lie out of that one. She got me into it. I can prove it.
Who was the real leader of the gang?
Milford. He started it. He organized the whole thing. He collects the stuff we get and he delivers it. Jansen helps him do it.
What do you mean he delivers the stuff? Where does he deliver it?
Somewhere in Dogtown, I think. Down around South Main, near the railroad yards.
Who's it delivered to?
I don't know exactly. I heard Jansen mention the name once. Myra, he said. It's supposed to be a big secret. Myra, that's all I remember.
Where does Jansen and Milford live?
Well, Jansen rooms down on East Flower. 1042, I think. It's a rooming house. And Milford lives two blocks over from me on Quincy. 234 Quincy. He lives with his grandmother.
Got that, Ben?
Right.
All right, let's pick up Milford and Jansen. It was 1:10 when Ben and I returned to headquarters with George Jansen and Fred Milford in our custody. In Jansen's room at 1042 East Flower Street, we found two fur coats, a box full of new car accessories, an S&W 38 revolver, and a .45 automatic. When we picked up Fred Milford at his home, we discovered 5 deluxe car radios hidden in the garage, plus a valuable assortment of cameras, cigarette lighters, and clothing. Both Jansen and Milford refused to talk. But when we got them to headquarters and showed them the signed statements of Stanley Freeman and the girl, Joanne Miller, they broke.
Milford, where else did you and your gang operate besides the Wilshire district?
No place, only out there, that's all.
Same type of car burglars have been committed all over the city. You telling us your gang didn't have a hand in them?
It's the truth. Our territory was Wilshire district. We didn't go outside.
You mean some other gang's responsible?
I don't know. All I know is we didn't have any part of them.
Is there another gang, Milford?
Maybe, I don't know. You find out. It's none of my business.
It is your business, Milford. You admit you and your gang committed 55 jobs in the past 3.5 months. That leaves about 200 jobs to be accounted for.
That's right. You figure it out.
We have figured it out. I think you and your gang of young thieves pulled every one of those 250 jobs. There isn't any other gang. That's the story the district attorney's going to get.
You're crazy. There is. I know there is.
Then give us the information and save yourself a lot of trouble.
Well, we're not the only ones. That's all I know.
Milford, do you know how many years you get for auto burglary?
I told you, we're not the only ones. There must be a couple of others besides us. Vince Mahoney, he's got a gang.
Where does Mahoney operate?
West Hollywood and Beverly.
Where does he live?
I don't know. Honest, I only met him a couple of times.
Where'd you meet him?
I don't remember.
Where'd you meet him, Milford?
Delivery. I met him down at the delivery place a couple of nights.
When you delivered the property you stole from cars, is that right?
Yeah.
Where was that?
Down by the railroad yard.
Where?
Chavez Street. It's a little alley off East Main.
Who'd you deliver the stuff to?
I told you, her name's Myra. That's all I know. We meet her and some guy on Tuesday nights. We give them the stuff and they pay us off. Mahoney delivers the same night I do.
Do you meet her every Tuesday night?
Yeah.
You're going to meet her this Tuesday, tomorrow night?
I don't know. I guess so.
Same place?
Yeah.
Are you the only one she deals with?
Sometimes Joanne. Near Joanne. I know what you're thinking. You want to use me to trap Myra. Well, what's it worth?
You know better than that.
How about it, Milford?
Oh, what else can I do? Give me another cigarette.
By 3:30 that morning, the signed statements and confessions were piling up fast. Milford gave us a list of the names and addresses of each member in his gang, and within an hour, they were all under questioning at headquarters. Most of the suspects, about one-third of them girls, ranged in age from 18 to 21. As they told their individual stories, the scope of the case grew until it covered most of the city. By late afternoon of the next day, Tuesday, March 3rd, 3 more gangs operating in Venice, Bel Air, and North Hollywood had been apprehended. They confessed to more than 175 burglaries from locked cars during the past 3.5 months. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, Ben and I met with Chief Backstrand in his office.
How many admissions you have now?
Over 50, Ed. Here are the gang leader's statements.
What's their story?
Well, pretty much the same. They all say this woman, Myra, set up the operation.
You mean she got the kids and put them to work burglarizing cars?
Well, not exactly. She picked the leaders, contacted them in bars or on the street, asked them if they wanted to pick up some spare money getting auto parts for it.
Then she didn't tell them to go out and burglarize cars?
Well, not in so many words, Ed, no. After they brought in auto parts for a couple of weeks, she told them to bring her everything they could find, outside the car or inside. Those are the words she used.
5 of the kids dictated those words into their signed confession.
That should hold in court. What else did you get on this woman?
Oh, she taught them how to work, told them to wear gloves, all angles.
Well, we got most of the small fry. Now, where do we find this Myra woman? Any description on her?
Yeah. Kids say she's about 33, 34. Good-looking redhead.
5 feet 5, about 120. Well read.
No description on the guy she runs with.
You run a make on her yet?
Yeah, no previous record. We set up a stakeout for her tonight. 2 of the gang leaders have volunteered to go along. This Milford and Vince Mahoney.
Good. Down on Chavez, where she usually meets them?
Yeah, that's right.
When?
11:15. That's the regular time for the meet, according to the kid.
All right, I'll be at home. Call me. I don't want to miss out on this one.
When Ben and I left Ed Backstrand's office, we went home for dinner and a few hours' sleep. At 9:30 p.m., we were back at the office. We met the men in the special detail, which Backstrand had assigned for the stakeout that night. We briefed them on their duties, and then we got Fred Milford and Vince Mahoney out of their cells. To avoid any possible suspicion of the presence of a trap, we had Milford's permission to use his car in the stakeout. The car which he had said he had driven to the delivery meetings with the woman Myra at least a dozen times before. We arrived at the stakeout area, Chavez Alley in East Main, at 9:58. The meeting was scheduled for 11:15. The moon was out, but the sky was overcast, and there was a cold wind blowing from the east.
Hey, what time you got, Sergeant?
About 10. Why, Milford? Getting nervous?
No, just wondering. How are you cops going to rig this thing?
In just a couple of minutes, we're going to plant you two in Milford's car parked up there in the alley. Now, you stay there until Myra shows up. We'll do the rest.
Yeah, I know, but what'll we say? Suppose she asks for some stuff. We ain't got any.
You won't need any. You won't have much time for talking.
Suppose she wises up. Maybe she'll pull a gun.
Maybe. Does she carry one?
No, never saw her with one.
Don't worry, Milford. We'll make sure you're not in danger.
She's got an awful temper, that redhead. Got mad at me once when I squawked at the prices she was paying us for radios.
What was she paying you, Mahoney?
An 8-tube radio, good shape, $7.
She got all the gravy and you got all the grief.
You're not kidding.
Joe, are you?
Yeah, Steve, what do you got?
Well, the men are all staked out, Joe. Got the area covered from every angle.
All right. You got an extra man to stay in Milford's car?
I'll handle that myself.
Fine, thanks.
Okay.
All set, Joe?
Yeah. Now, Milford, Mahoney, we're going to put you two in your car now. There's going to be an officer with you, so there's no need to be nervous or afraid. You just sit in the car and act natural. When this Myra drives up, don't leave the car. Have her come to you. You got it?
Sure. Okay.
All right, Joe, let's go.
Sure is cold out. I don't even have a heater in my car.
You stole enough of them.
Okay, Steve, here they are.
All right, boys. Milford, get in first behind the wheel.
Okay.
Mahoney in the middle. I'll sit in the back.
We'll be parked in that garage across the street, Steve. Got a perfect view of the alley.
Okay, Ben. Check with you later.
All right. Mean night, Joe.
Yeah, come on. It's cold here in the garage, isn't it?
Yeah. And it might be a long wait. What time you got?
6 minutes past 10.
Thank you. Joe.
What is it?
It's nothing. Thought that passing car was turning in the alley.
Relax. It's early.
Lonely place. Dark. Gets on your nerves.
That's it, Ben. 11:30. Nothing yet.
Somebody might have tipped her off.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. Now, let's wait it out anyway.
Joe, that blue coupe
there just turned in the alley. Let's go. Come on, run, Ben.
Behind you.
All right, I'll let Crusher fight.
What'd you get, Steve?
Here he is. Just drove up in the coupe. Got out and called Milford Mahoney by the first names. He's in on it.
What about the girl?
No sign. Kid was the only one in the car.
All right. Tell them in the stakeout's offered tonight. Have him report back in. We'll take the kid with us.
Okay.
All right, young fellow. This way.
What do you cops think you're doing? I ain't done nothing.
Look, sport. We heard that from 54 different kids yesterday. We're tired of that line. Come on.
When we got back to the office, we took the boy to the interrogation room and questioned him. He gave his name as Matthew Leiter, age 21. He wouldn't break until Vince Mahoney definitely identified him as a member of his car burglary gang and the special favorite of the red-headed woman they called Myra. Then Leiter copped out and told Ben and I that he had talked with Myra as late as 10 o'clock tonight. He told us that she had heard that the police had picked up some of the gang members, and she asked Leiter to drive down to the Chavez Alley meeting place. He was supposed to tell Milford and Mahoney that the weekly delivery date was off until further notice. We questioned Matthew Leiter for an hour and a half.
You told us a little while ago that you talked with this woman, Myra, late tonight.
Yeah.
Where'd you talk to her? At home?
At home? Don't be stupid. Nobody knows where she lives. I met her at a bar.
Which bar?
Julius. Out in Santa Monica.
How did she contact you?
Called me at home. She's not such a bad dame. She treats you right.
Sure, that's why you're in jail. Did you ever call her on the phone?
I don't know her number. None of the kids do. She's smart. She taught me all I know about the racket. You'll have a rough time getting her.
Maybe, but we'll get her. Ben and I left the office at 2 a.m. and went home to bed. We reported in at 8 that morning to Ed Backstrand. The three of us went down the street to Kokin's restaurant for a cup of coffee. Nobody was in a good mood. We had most or all the small fry in the citywide burglary ring, but it seemed we were still a long way from cracking the inner circle.
The latter kid said that none of them knows where she lives, what her phone number is, nothing. Pass the sugar in.
I think we still have a few angles to study on that score. Right now, I've got some more bad news for you.
What's that?
You been through your mail this morning?
No, not yet. We haven't had a chance.
I saw the overnight reports. There were 32 car burglaries last night. 32. All the way from Wilmington to North Hollywood. How you figure it?
I can't. This girl Myra must have an army of kids working for her.
How much did they get, Ed? Any idea?
Rough estimate, about $3,000. Usual stuff people are foolish enough to leave in their cars. Watches, cameras, furs, expensive clothes.
M.O.'s the same?
Like the others. If the car happens to have a rigid handle lock, they slip a piece of pipe over the handle for a lever and break it. If that doesn't work, they pry open the wing window. Some of the windows were smashed out.
Sounds like you're in an awful hurry, Joe.
Yeah, maybe this Myra wants a few big nights before she peddles the stuff and gets out.
If we're going to get her, we can't waste time.
Any suspects picked up last night, Skipper?
None.
Well, where did they hit most of the car?
Outside the Pan Pacific, the parking lot. Hockey game going on. Must have been 4,000 cars for them to pick over. They picked the best.
As usual.
Well, you better get on it. There's one way to handle it.
What's that?
She works fast. You work a little faster.
We got back to the office and we went over the reports one by one. Then we called the young gang members to the interrogation room and questioned them separately and re-questioned them. We got nowhere. Many of them had met Myra on the street, in a bar, but not one of them had any idea where she lived. At least that's what they told us. Ben had a hunch that Matthew Leiter knew more than he was telling. We had him brought to the interrogation room, and all that afternoon until 10 o'clock that night, with interruptions for his meal periods, we talked with Leiter. He would admit nothing more than what he'd already told us.
Yeah, it's got me beat, Joe.
Yeah. Now, let's check with Ed.
Good morning, Joe.
Ben? Hi, Mike. Skipper in?
Just went down the hall for a minute. Right back. Hold it a minute, will you? Yeah. Chief of Detectives always handed. Yeah. Well, you, Joe.
Oh, thanks. Hello? Yeah. He does? We'll be right over. That was Sergeant Hopkins over at the jail.
Yeah?
Matthew Leiter's got something to tell us. Says it's important.
Have a chair here, Leiter.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, you wanted to see us.
I'm getting even with that dame Myra. I'm squaring with you.
Yeah?
She told me if I was picked up, she'd have me out in a couple of hours. She promised me a lawyer if anything happened. Said she'd get me bail.
All right, where can we find her?
I don't know if she's there now, but you can find out at Francisco Motors. Big used car lot. Garage, too. It's out on Melrose past La Cienega.
What's the time?
That's where she fenced most of the stuff we stole. Some old guy she buddies with runs the place. Big shop in the back. Store a lot of hot stuff there.
Barney.
Yes, Sergeant?
We're through with him. Take him back. We checked with Chief Backstrand, and then we drove out to the Francisco Motor Company. We located it on the corner of Melrose and Geneva Avenue. It was a big layout. It consisted of a large used car lot sign bannering the slogan, Deluxe Auto Accessories. Lowest prices in town. Along the back end of the lot, there was a large L-shaped garage. We found the man in charge, and he gave his name as Paul Hackett, the owner of the car lot. In the garage, we found the entrance to a large back storeroom. It was loaded with thousands of dollars worth of auto radios, spotlights, cratefuls of assorted car accessories. Special closets built into the walls of the garage contained racks of fur coats, suits, dresses. Below that, smaller boxes containing watches and cameras, all wrapped in tissue paper.
You can save all of us a lot of time and trouble by talking to us now, Mr. Hackett. Where is Myra?
I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about.
Can you explain what we just found in your garage?
I didn't know it was there. I didn't know it was stolen.
Well, which is it, Mr. Hackett? Make up your mind.
I bought it, but I didn't know it was stolen. You can't prove I did know.
I think we can prove it, Mr. Hackett. Some of those stolen car radios stored back there, the serial numbers are filed off, and this workbench here is full of filings.
I didn't know.
You'll have to do better than that.
How does Myra figure in?
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's all right with us, Hackett. We found the stuff and we got you. If we don't find Myra, you'll be doing time for two people. Stand still.
You can't. You can't do this to me. I don't know anything about it.
Come on, Hackett. We're taking you in. All right, get in the car. Come on, in the car.
Am I going to jail?
You're going to jail.
All right. I'll take you to Myra.
Hackett told us that Myra lived at 1345 Munich Drive in Beverly Hills. He said that he was Myra's husband. He told us that he'd been in a legitimate garage business for 10 years before he married Myra. She talked him into the racket. He identified 1345 Munich Drive as their home. When we got there, we found stores of stolen property similar to those found in the garage. Myra was not there. Hackett had no idea where she might be. We sat down in the living room and waited. One hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. After 5 hours of waiting, the monotony started to wear on everybody's nerves, especially Hackett's.
And the whole thing, it was her idea. I should have known, all her. She did this to me. I won't take it alone. Where is she?
You tell us, Hackett.
I told you, I don't know. She couldn't have gone. She didn't know. I'm not going to take this alone.
Quiet down, quiet down.
That's you, Paul? Thought I heard you talking to some. Who's he?
The police, Myra. The police. Your smart kids told them the whole story.
What are you talking about, my smart kids? What are these cops doing here in the living room?
That's enough.
Oh, get your dirty hands off me. Get away.
These kids are right, Joe. She got a temper.
Who do you think you're...
Yeah, that ought to hold you for a while. All right, come on, you two. Let's go.
All right, copper. You win. Stupid husband. How many times did I tell you? Don't trust those kids. Don't store the stuff in the garage. Don't open it for anybody. Get a lawyer. No, you knew better. Dumb jerk. The idea of having those cops camping in the living room waiting for me. Why didn't you warn me? I'm going to divorce you. That's what I'm going to do. I'll stick you for plenty. Jerk.
All right, inside you two.
You got a smoke, Ben?
Yeah.
Thanks. I was just thinking.
What?
Those kids were right. She's a pretty nice-looking woman.
Yeah. Nice face. Beautiful figure.
Mm-hmm. Sure talks a lot, though, doesn't she?
Yeah. Hey, Joe, remind me to take home some flowers to my wife tonight, will you?
The story you have just heard is true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
Paul and Myra Hackett were tried and convicted on 7 separate counts of receiving stolen property. They are now serving out their sentences in the state penitentiary. Realizing that most of the young persons involved in the case were influenced by the strong personality of Paul and Myra Hackett, a separate investigation was made into the backgrounds and home life of the young offenders. In most cases, they were found to be basically good, and they were placed on probation and returned to their homes. Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. Investigated and solved by the men who unrelentingly stand watch on the security of your home, your family, and your life. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Wednesday, September 15th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on the way back from lunch, and it was 12:56 when I got to room 42. Homicide.
Hi, Joe. Waiting for you.
Hiya, Ben. Al.
Hi.
I hear you got something for us.
Here's a report right here. Gardener by the name of Eric Kelby called in day before yesterday. Said his wife disappeared from their home out in the valley Sunday night. Says he thinks she left him.
That happens every day, Bargetti.
Not this way, it doesn't. Walsh and I went out yesterday to interview the guy. Story doesn't add.
Why not?
Well, none of her clothes are missing. None of her luggage. She even left her pocketbook behind, full of money. Found out from the neighbors a missing woman is a 17-year-old boy by a former marriage.
So what?
An only child. Mother dotes on the kid. Shouldn't even say goodbye to him.
How did this Sarah Kelby impress you?
Pretty grouchy with Walsh and me. No cooperation.
Wants to find his wife, doesn't he?
I don't know if he does or not. It's no help, I'll tell you that.
I see that report a minute now.
Here you are.
Agnes Trumbull Kelby, age 39.
Kelby's her second husband. First one died a little after the boy was born.
Mm-hmm. Disappeared Sunday night from her home, 546 Belasco Road, between 7 and 8 o'clock. When did Kelby call in?
Monday afternoon. Said he thought his wife might be spending the night with her sister. When he found out she wasn't, called us.
Did you meet the boy while you were out there, Borghetti?
Yeah, that's another thing. Kid came riding in on a bike while we were talking with the neighbors. Trying to talk to him, but the old man came out hustling him inside the house. Then he starts eating us out.
What'd he say?
Told us it was our job to find his wife, not to go prying into his stepson's affairs.
Well, that's a new slant. How about her friends and relatives around here, Al? Any besides her sister?
Walsh located a couple of her aunts. I don't think he's checked them yet, though. I'll tell you, boys, this is one I'll bet on.
Maybe. You got the names of Mrs. Kelby's relatives?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right over here. Sure wish we had a chance to talk to that boy.
Yeah. How's it feel to you, Ben?
I don't know. Notice anything else funny about the guy, Al?
I don't know. Here's those names, Joe.
Thanks.
Kelby was upset, all right. For some reason, it didn't strike me as reacting the way a normal guy reacts when his wife disappears.
All right, Al. How would you react?
Borghetti's worrying again.
Oh, now listen, boys. It's no fooling matter. This is one I'll bet on. It's a homicide.
All right. How about a copy of this report?
Yeah, where'll I get the phone? Missing persons, Borghetti. Who's that? Oh. Yeah. Yeah. About what? Oh, sure. All right, son. 4 o'clock. Yeah. Goodbye. That was Kelby's stepson.
What do you want?
Think something's happened to his mother.
In police work, missing persons detail is not a department separate in itself. It is organized as a part of the Homicide Bureau. According to Borghetti, who took the call, the boy said he suspected his stepfather, and he didn't want him to know of any meeting between him and the police officers. He would meet the officers that afternoon at 4 p.m. in a restaurant on the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue. At 3:15, Ben and I left the office and drove out to the meeting place, the Dairyland Fountain and Coffee Shop. We arrived there at 3:45. At 5:08, the Kelby boy still had not arrived.
Youngster's not very prompt.
Let's wait a little while longer.
Yeah. Smoke?
Yeah, thanks.
Want more coffee?
No, thanks. I guess the boy isn't going to show.
Think something's happened?
15 minutes after we left the coffee shop, we drove up in front of the gate of the Kelby Nursery on Belasco Road. The house itself was set well back on the property, which covered about 4 acres. The entire nursery was surrounded by a 6-foot steel wire fence. It looked like almost every available foot of ground inside was planted with some kind of a flower or shrub. Kelby met us at the gate.
Yes? What do you men want?
Police officers. Are you Mr. Kelby?
Yes. What do you want?
Well, if you'll shut those dogs up for a minute, we'd like to ask you a few questions.
I'm busy now. Can't you come back tomorrow?
Pretty important, Mr. Kelby. I think we better talk right now.
All right, if you have to. Fred, John, down. You too, honey. Quiet.
All right. Now, what do you want?
Mind if we come inside?
These watchdogs of mine are pretty vicious. We can talk here at the gate.
All right, Mr. Kelby. This is Sergeant Romero. My name's Friday. We've been assigned to look into your wife's disappearance.
Oh. Did you find anything yet?
Nothing definite. Maybe you can help us. Would you tell us exactly what happened the night your wife disappeared?
What do you mean, what happened?
Well, when did you last see her? When did you first notice she was gone?
We finished up Sunday night dinner about 7 o'clock, and I laid down for a nap. Agnes went out on the front porch for some air. Woke up a little before 8 and went outside to look for her. She was gone.
Nobody saw her leave, Mr. Kelby?
Not that I know of. Maybe some of our nosy neighbors, I don't know.
How about your stepson? Wasn't he around Sunday night?
Bruce? No, went out to a show. Some other kids.
When did he get back from the show?
About 10, I think. Why?
Where's your stepson now?
Who are you looking for, my wife or my stepson?
Both, Mr. Kelby. Where's your stepson?
Gone. I took him over to my sister's in Alhambra.
been feeling bad since his mother disappeared. Figured the change would do him good.
Why did you take him over to your sister's, Telby?
This afternoon. What's that got to do with it?
We'd like to talk to Bruce.
No, I can't allow it. The boy's too upset. I can't allow it.
I'm afraid you're going to have to allow it.
Listen, mister, you can get off this property right now. No cops giving me sass.
Nobody's giving you sass, Telby. We want to talk to your stepson, that's all. He might give us a clue as to the whereabouts of your wife.
And I say you can't see the boy. What's more, you cops couldn't find thorns in a rose patch. I'll get somebody else to look for Agnes. It's my business anyway. Nobody else's.
It's our business, too, if anything's happened to her.
What are you talking about?
You better get your coat, Mr. Kelby. We're taking you in for questioning.
You come through that gate, and I'm going to let these dogs go accidentally.
I'd hate to shoot the dog. Now go on in the house and get your coat. Eric Kelby turned and made his way up the path and into the house. 5 minutes later, he came out. Without a word to either of us, he came down the path, closed the gate behind him, and got into our car. On the way back to headquarters, he chatted pleasantly about the weather, the nursery business, and his dogs. When we pulled up in front of the city hall, we met the reason for his sudden change in temperament. His lawyer was waiting for us at the door. We took Kelby to one of the interrogation rooms. His lawyer tagged along. We tried to question him, but the lawyer objected to 2 out of every 3 questions we asked. It was hopeless, and we knew it. So did the lawyer. We released Kelby, but we did get the name and address of his sister where the stepson Bruce was staying. After they left, Ben and I got back in the car and drove out to Alhambra to check on the boy.
Forget he had this in peg right, Joe. He's a real sleeper.
Yeah. I'd like to know how the stepson missed that date with us this afternoon.
Well, if the kid called us from the house, his stepfather could have overheard him.
It's possible. Sister's house ought to be along this block, shouldn't
it? Yeah, let's see. 1408, 1406. That is your great cottage, 1402.
Right. It's a nice looking little place, isn't it? Well kept.
Yeah, it's a nice neighborhood. Wonder how the lot prices run out here. Somebody's coming.
Yes, what is it?
Police officers, ma'am. Are you Miss Kelby?
Bertha Kelby, yes, that's my name. Why?
We talked to your brother earlier today, Miss Kelby. He said that you brought his stepson, Bruce, here to stay for a while. We'd like to see him.
Bruce? Yes, he was here till about, an hour and a half ago. I went to the store, and when I came back, he was gone.
Have you any idea where he might be, Miss Kelby?
Well, I telephoned my brother Eric's place just before you came to the door. He's not there. I don't know where he might be. I'm worried about him. He seems so upset. It's business about his mother's disappearance, you know.
Do you mind if we came in and looked around, Miss Kelby?
Well, no, not at all.
We went in and looked the house over from one end to the other. There wasn't a trace of the boy. We drove back to Kelby's nursery and satisfied ourselves the boy wasn't there. Then we came back to Alhambra and kept an eye on Miss Bertha Kelby's home until midnight. No one came or went. At 5 minutes past midnight, the lights went off in the living room and a few minutes later in the back of the house. The next morning, when Ben and I checked in for work as usual at 8 o'clock, we met with Captain of Homicide, Frank Kearney.
What makes you two so positive there has been any foul play in this Kelby thing?
That's just it, Cap. We're not positive. It's a whole setup. It smells bad.
For instance?
That lawyer. If a man's innocent, he doesn't need a lawyer to sit with him in the interrogation room and tell him not to answer questions. Number 2, that kid's telephone call.
Maybe he doesn't get along with his stepfather. It happens, you know. Maybe he's trying to get back at him for something or other.
Maybe. Then why is Kelby hiding him out?
You're sure he's hiding him out?
No other way to take it, Cap.
The Kelby woman walked away from her home Sunday night. Nobody saw her. She took nothing with her. No clothes, no luggage, no money. You checked with the family doctor?
Yesterday. He told us Mrs. Kelby was in perfect health. We double-checked the wanderer's file and the repeater's file and missing persons. Couldn't find her name in either one.
How about her relatives in town?
Haven't had a chance to talk to them yet, Cap. We'll check them this morning.
Well, one thing's certain. The woman couldn't have gone very far.
We checked the sheriff's office, the jails, the hospital.
Sent out a teletype and an APB. Every cop in the city has her description. She's been gone almost 4 days, but nobody's seen her. How does that add up to you?
It doesn't. You better move on it. Check every one of Mrs. Kelby's friends and relatives.
Right, Frank.
Then try the neighbors. As long as I've been a cop, neighbors have been able to tell everything about anyone.
All that day, Ben and I made the rounds. First stop was the Western National Bank, where Mrs. Kelby maintained her account. Her savings statement showed a total balance of $31,564.17. Her separate checking account had a balance of $842.71. At the Farmers Mutual, we found the record of an insurance policy issued to Agnes Trumbull Kelby. It was a 20-pay life policy covering the insured in the amount of $30,000. The beneficiary was listed as the insured's son, Bruce Trumbull Kelby, if living upon the receipt of such due proof. If not, the insured's husband, Eric J. Kelby. By the time we finished checking her financial status, the odds were piling up fast. From only casual reports, we knew that Eric Kelby was a frugal man. If he was greedy as well, if he wanted and needed money badly enough to kill, then he had all the motives necessary to murder his wife. Maybe his stepson, too. Ben and I started to make rounds of Mrs. Kelby's friends and relatives. Our first stop was at the apartment of Agnes Kelby's sister, a talkative maiden lady in her early 60s.
Agnes just isn't that kind. Oh, I'm worried sick about this. I really am. And Bruce, the poor lad, he must be hot sick. And Eric, what does Eric say about all this?
He says he thinks his wife left him.
Left him? Why, that's ridiculous. How strange.
Can you think of any good reason why your sister would leave Mr. Kelby?
No. They had tiffs, of course, small ones. But, of course, there was that argument about Bruce. The two of them always seemed to be arguing about Bruce.
How do you mean, ma'am?
Oh, well, raising the boy and all, you know. The last time I talked to them, they were tiffing about whether or not Bruce should be paid for working in the nursery for Eric. And the strangest thing, Eric seemed to be so upset about it all. Imagine. All on account of paying the boy a few dollars for good, honest work in that silly nursery. Well, you know, I'm the outspoken kind, and I just told Eric. Eric, I said, don't be an old meanie. Pay the boy.
That was the extent of the information which Mrs. Kelby's sister had to offer. Next, we called on an aunt, Mrs. James D. Trumbull, 83 years old. She could hardly understand our questions, let alone answer them. She hadn't seen her niece, Agnes, in a year. After that, we paid a visit to one of Mrs. Kelby's friends, a Mrs. Lillian Humboldt.
Well, I'm sorry, Sergeant, but I can't think of any good reason why she would leave him. Unless that silly business about Bruce got out of hand. You know, maybe Eric is just a little jealous of him.
Next, we called on Daisy McLeod, who worked as a day maid for Mrs. Kelby.
Officer, what Mr. and Mrs. Kelby thought, what they said, what they did, it's none of my business. I come in the morning, I do my work, I do it well. I'm not the nosy type, and I don't pry. I take half an hour for lunch, and when I'm through, I take my pay, and I don't expect tips, and I take the bus home. I'm not the peeking through the keyhole kind, sneaking around corners listening. But what I couldn't tell you about that man.
Exactly what do you mean, Miss McLeod?
Oh, he's a hard man, you know. They're always arguing about the boy. Bruce this, Bruce that. He's a nice boy, I think. He's never done anything to me. Oh, the arguments. Him and her all the time. Should the boy be paid for working? Shouldn't he? Why? Why not?
When Ben and I finished with the list of Mrs. Kelby's friends, relatives, and employees, we started out on the neighbors. None of them saw Mrs. Kelby after 6 p.m. the night she disappeared. Two of the neighbors said they saw the porch light burning after 7 p.m., but both said the porch was empty. Mrs. Kelby was not sitting in her chair at the usual time after dinner. According to them, that was one of her habits. It was 6:10 by the time Ben and I got back to the office. The light was still burning in Captain Kearney's office.
All day, Joe. Not a money.
Yeah. I wonder what the captain's hanging around for.
Let's find out.
Get anything?
Pretty good luck, Cap.
Good. I've got some more for you. Just walked in 5 minutes ago.
What do you mean, Frank? Who walked in?
Bruce Kelby. He's waiting in the next room.
We went in the next room and met Bruce Kelby. He was small for a 17-year-old, dark-haired and a little on the sickly side. He told us that he couldn't keep the date he made with us on the phone because his stepfather apparently did overhear the conversation and drove him directly to his sister's home in Alhambra. We asked him why he was so sure that his stepfather was responsible for his mother's sudden disappearance.
For one thing, all three of us usually go to the early show on Sunday night. Eric, Mom, and me. But last Sunday, Eric said he wasn't feeling good and he wanted Mom to stay home and take care of him. Then he told me to go on ahead to the show, so I did.
What time did you get home, son?
About 9:30, 9:45.
What was your stepfather doing when you got home?
Sitting in the living room, reading the paper.
Did you notice anything unusual about the way he acted?
Well, he was nervous and jumpy, more than usual, I think.
Anything else?
Yes, sir. When I came in through the front yard, I noticed the dogs had mud all over their paws. They'd been out somewhere in the nursery plots. And they won't go out in the plots unless Eric's with them. He doesn't want them to trample the seedlings.
What would your stepfather be doing out in the nursery at night? Does he usually do some work at night?
No, sir. None of the plots are even lighted. Only the greenhouses.
And the paths in the greenhouses are usually graveled, I think. No mud around.
It's my job to see that the greenhouse paths are kept graveled. I know they're not muddy. I fixed them the day before, Saturday.
What do you think it means, son?
What? I don't know. I don't want to think about it. I just know he's done something. He's done something to her.
Did your stepfather give you any reason for keeping you away from the police officers the other day?
No, sir. He said people were getting nosy, and he said it might be better for me over at Aunt Bertha's. She's his sister.
Do you think your Aunt Bertha might know where your mother is?
No, we hardly ever see her. We don't know her well at all.
We've heard your mother and your stepfather argued about whether you should be paid for your work in the nursery.
When I started to work for him, he promised he'd pay me. I was saving up to buy a 31 Model A. And then after a couple of months, when he didn't pay me, I asked him. He told me I ought to be glad to work for him for nothing.
And your mother argued with him over that?
Sure, it was her money that bought the nursery anyway.
How'd you get away from your aunt's place last night?
Well, Bertha had some shopping to do, and she left me alone. She locked the door to my room. Even the screen over the window in my room was nailed down, but I kicked it out and got away. I stayed at a friend's house last night.
Thought about where you're going to stay tonight?
I don't know. But I'm not going home. And I'm not going back to Bertha's place either. I'll get a room.
How'd you like to stay at my house a few days?
Sure nice of you, sir. Maybe I'd better not. Mom might not like it.
Oh, I'll take care of that. Now let's hop out and get some dinner.
Sure darn nice of you, sir.
All right, son. Come with me.
What do you think, Joe?
He could be lying?
Yeah.
Now what, Jeff? Can we bring Kelby in again?
No, not yet. He's found out by now from his sister that the boy's gone. He probably figures the police station is the first place he'd come.
Wouldn't do much good pulling him in now, Ben. We couldn't even question him. 10 to 1 his lawyer'd be waiting for us when we got back.
That's the problem. How do we get to this Kelby without his lawyer finding out?
Well, what about the early morning, Jeff? Say tomorrow, about 5 or 6 a.m. Think he'd be looking for us then?
Yeah, that might do it.
We can just get by that pack of hounds he owns without waking the whole neighborhood. Might work.
If we could just question him alone, I've got an idea it wouldn't take much to make him cop out.
All right, give it a try. Get out there in the early morning and bring him in for questioning as quietly as possible. I'll be in at 6 a.m. If you want me before then, call me at home.
All right, Frank.
Kelby's got a smart lawyer. It's going to be plenty hard to convict him without a body and corroborating evidence.
He's got 4 acres out there, Cap. You can hide a lot of bodies in 4 acres.
Well, that's what I mean. This case isn't ending. It's just beginning.
The next morning, Ben and I met at the office about a few minutes past 4 a.m. We had a cup of coffee and a donut at an all-night restaurant, and then we started for the Kelby place out on Belasco Road. We took 4 pounds of fresh horse meat with us to keep the dogs quiet if they raised a fuss. It was 28 minutes past 4 when Ben pulled the car to a stop a few hundred feet from the gate to the Kelby nursery. We got out of the car and made our way down the road to the gate. I reached in and tried the latch. It was padlocked. The dog started in. Okay, Ben, looks like we'll have to jump the fence. Toss some of that horse meat over to him.
Yeah. Here.
That's it. Come on, let's climb.
Keep an eye on those hounds. Looks like they could chew your leg off.
Yeah. Here comes a third one, Ben. Toss some more meat.
Yeah. There you are, boy. Go get it. Go get it.
Look, Ben, light's going on in the house.
Come on, let's make it fast.
Who is it? Who's there? I'll set the dogs on you.
Police officers, Mr. Kelby.
What? What are you doing out here this time of night?
You're under arrest, Kelby. Get your coat.
You cops are asking for a peck of trouble.
Get your coat.
Where's my stepson? What have you done with him?
What have you done with your wife?
You're going to pay for this. I'll have your jobs.
That's not the first time we heard that, Kelby. Let's go. Light's burning in the captain's office.
Yeah. All right, Kelby, in here.
Pay for this, mark my word.
Ben, take him in the office here and stay with him. I'll see if Frank's in yet.
Right, Joe. Come on, Kelby, inside.
Friday, you bring in Kelby?
He's down in the interrogation room. Ben's with him.
Somebody saw you?
Don't think so.
They must have. Kelby's lawyer's sitting in the next room.
Kelby again refused to answer any questions without the advice of his attorney. We released him. That day, Captain Kearney sent out two men to keep an eye on the nursery and report on all of Kelby's movements. Shortly after 7 o'clock that night, just after nightfall, we tried once again to bring in Kelby for questioning without his lawyer's knowledge. It didn't work. A little after we booked him, his lawyer obtained a writ of habeas corpus. We had to release him again. The two men assigned to stake out the Kelby place reported definitely that somebody was tipping the lawyer whenever unknown visitors showed up at the nursery and drove off with Kelby. There was nothing we could do about it. Next morning, Kearney came up with a lead.
I had a long talk with the boy last night. Accidentally, I think he's given us a pretty good lead.
Yeah?
There's only one way we'll ever get a conviction. That's by finding the body and evidence to tie Kelby in.
Yeah, that'll do it. Where do we start looking?
In a new rose bed next to one of the greenhouses in Kelby's nursery.
Hmm?
The kid came up with it last night.
How come?
First, Kelby's crazy about saving a dollar and making one.
Yeah.
In the nursery trade, especially where you have a limited area to work in, like Kelby, you cultivate every foot of ground. Every bit of soil you got is planted with something.
Mm-hmm.
Kelby's not the type to waste anything. Especially he's not the kind that would let ground lie fallow when he could plant something that might bring in a few dollars next season. Bruce tells me his stepfather has every inch of those 4 acres planted. Every inch. Except a 6 by 9 foot plot of ground in that rose garden.
Well, that sounds like a long shot to me, Frank.
Boy said he prepared that piece of ground for planting late Saturday afternoon. His stepfather wanted it ready for Sunday morning. The plot of ground's still vacant.
I'd have planted it yesterday, Cap. When's the last time you checked?
Before I came to work this morning. I called the men on stakeout next to the nursery. They tell me the plot's still empty.
Mm-hmm. It's worth a chance, Frank. When do we look it over?
Tonight. I don't want Kelby or his lawyer to know a thing until we find that body.
Well, how are we going to work it?
We load her up a crew from the crime lab. They can take probings through that plot and all around it. They can tell us without any guesswork how deep that ground's been worked over lately.
When do you want to start?
Be here in the office at 8:30 tonight. If my hunches are any good, we'll find the body.
It was 9:10 that night when we got to the Kelby place. Lieutenant Lee Jones and his assistants, Kearney, Ben, and two other men from homicide. The men on stakeout told us that Kelby had left about 20 minutes before in a dark blue coupe. Ben brought along the usual supply of horse meat for the dogs, so we didn't have any trouble there. We found the empty plot of ground in the rose bed next to the greenhouse, exactly as Bruce described it to Kearney.
Ground's been worked over all right, boys. At least 4 to 5 feet down.
All right, Lee, let's start digging. Romero, take care of the dogs. Watson, grab one of these shovels.
Right, Cap.
Hey, Kelby said these dogs were vicious, didn't he?
Yeah, why?
Look at these hounds. They're no more vicious than a lively soul, look.
Higgins, get that light over here, will you? Thanks.
What is it, Lee?
Let me see. Teeth. Set of false teeth.
Been in the ground long?
Don't think so, judging from the shape they're in.
How far down would you say, Yarley? A
couple of feet. Ground's real soft.
Lee, come here a minute.
What is it?
Body. Here's the shoulder.
All right, you men over here with Watson. Get the dirt off the face. Romero, you got a picture of the Kelby woman?
Yeah, Cap. Let's see. Here it is.
Thanks. Get the light down here.
Hunch paid off, Frank. That's her. Ben and I went back to the car and notified communications to broadcast a want for murder on Eric Kelby. His description, together with a description of the car and license number of the car he was driving, was rebroadcast every 15 minutes. Then we went back to check the house. We found the front door unlocked. We went inside and looked around. In one bedroom, we found clothes scattered over the bed and the floor. There was only one old suit remaining in the closet. On the table next to the bed, we found an airline's timetable. We got to the phone and notified communications to alert all police details at railroad stations, bus terminals, and airlines, and then to send out an APB on the teletype. After that, we checked with the airlines. One of them told us that a man answering Kelby's description had booked passage for Mexico City. The plane was scheduled to take off at 10:40 that night from Burbank Airport. Ben's watch said 10:04. We called the detail at the airport and alerted them. Then we drove over to check in person. It was 10:35 p.m. when Ben and I took up our positions just inside Gate 3, where passengers were boarding Flight 72 from Mexico City.
He's cutting it close, Joe. Got about 4 minutes more to get plane.
We waited. The crowd got thicker as departure time came closer. At 10:39, Eric Kelby came through the main entrance, across the terminal, through Gate 3, into a pair of handcuffs.
I don't understand. What does this mean?
We found your wife's body, Kelby.
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
In the rose patch next to the greenhouse. Your lawyer can't help this time.
Mexico City. Would have been a nice trip. Expensive.
I'll plead insanity. I didn't know what I was doing.
Be a nice vacation there, Cure Joe, Mexico City. I'm going to talk to my wife about it.
I didn't mean it. She slapped me. We were arguing about the boy. I didn't mean it.
I don't know if you did or not, Shelby, but you killed her. Come on. You missed your plane.
And that closes the file of tonight's trio of cases. My goodness, that was an effort and a half to remaster these guys. I've included in the Patreon notes what I've actually done, or rather what it looks like to edit these wonderful episodes, so do take a look when you get a chance. We had a fallen cadet at the academy whose silence spoke volumes, a redhead ringleader with the city's worth of car keys jingling in her purse, and a missing wife whose husband's story couldn't survive a little sunlight. Justice doesn't always knock, it listens, it waits, and sometimes it digs through wallpaper. And speaking of unwavering support, amazing loyalty, and massive hearts, tonight's tales are brought to life with thanks to our extraordinary Patreons. Firstly, I want to thank my amazing Ode Night Tea Titan, Matto Star. When a case hits a dead end and Friday's chewing on the last lead like it's yesterday's donut, HQ doesn't panic. They call him Matto Star, the Ode Night Tea Titan himself. Codename Steam Division Section 9. He doesn't flash a badge, he doesn't ask questions, he just pours a cup, leans in, and listens. At the academy, the whole department was chasing ghosts. Matto walked by the hallway once, took one deep breath, and muttered, "The truth stuck in his gait. That limp ain't from training, it's guilt." Case solved. Friday needed a sit down after that one. With Myra the redhead, every detective was distracted by her charm. Matto sipped, looked her dead in the eye and said, "You flinch every time someone mentions Chevy. Tell me why." She confessed before the steam cleared the rim of the cup. As for Eric Kelby, the man had a story airtight enough to fool a polygraph. But Matto just tilted his head and said, "You've been lying so long, even your posture gave up." Eric broke like oversteeped leaves in 10 seconds flat. Some folks chase down the truth. Matto Star just walks in, tastes the air, and finds it. To our Ode Night Tea Titan, your perception's sharper than a cross-examination, cooler than Friday's fedora, and more reliable than the LAPD's best. Thanks for keeping the steam hot and the lies cold. Have a kick-ass week ahead, Matto, and thank you for your friendship and undying support. You're awesome. I now want to thank my white tea warlords. Lezosaurus Rex. Lezza busted down more plot holes than Eric Kelby had alibis. Between deadlifts and detective work, Lezza casually benched a Buick while asking, "You sure that's a wrench in her purse and not a crowbar?" We raise a teacup and also a dumbbell in your honor, you absolute legend. Thank you, Lezza, for your awesome stalwart support, unending friendship. And here's to an amazing gym session, of which you're undoubtedly listening to me through right now. Thank you so much. Have a brilliant week ahead, Lezza. And Maya. Maya's cat once knocked over a case file that led us to Myra the Redhead. Coincidence? Or feline foresight? With claws sharper than cross-examination and a knack for curling up right where you're trying to read evidence, Maya. You keep the mystery fluffy and fabulous. Maya, have an amazing week ahead, and thank you so much for your awesome support as well. And Sangeetha. When Friday gets stuck, he calls the department seer, Sangeetha. She doesn't need clues, just a faint scent of lipstick and a half-heard whisper on the wind. Tonight, she foresaw the truth in a nursery wallpaper's swirl, and also warned us never trust anyone who doesn't like tea. Wise. Thank you, Sangeetha, for your awesome support. And have a kick-butt week ahead of you. Thank you to my Ode Night Tea Titan, and a big thank you to my White Tea Warlords. Absolute superstars. And now I want to thank my Ogre Enforcers. And all tiers thereafter. I am lucky to have Chad Warren, Divided by Zero, Juicebox Andy, Juss Heather, Paige Kramer, Peter Raffaelli, Rhonda Ray, Seductive Smiles, Jane Gumnick, and Michael Krupp. An absolute pleasure to have your support. If you are considering supporting the podcast, visit www.patreon.com/SFGT. If you want to listen to the podcast through your browser, you can visit my website, storiesfablesghostlytales.com, where you'll have links to Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and iHeartRadio, with all the hot links there. Thank you so much for listening. Have an amazing week ahead of yourselves, and I'll see you next week for some more tales. See you soon.
Koski dropped cold on the mat. Training mishap, yeah, we all bought that. Boots tied wrong, wide-eyed shake. You don't trip like that unless you're fake. Truth leaks slow in locker room hush. And brass looked down with a coward's blush. Steam on the window, fog in the glass. Secrets sweat and futures pass. This city hums through badge and brass. Justice don't blink, it just lets time pass.
Myra wore red like it earned her tips. Popped car doors with roses and lips. 200 rides, one ghost in red. The kids got pinched, she stayed ahead. I said, Chevy on third, a grin went tight. She told me plenty without saying it right. Steam on the window, fog in the glass. Whispers cut deep but never last. She moved like sin on shattered glass. And truth caught up with a cold, sharp gasp.
Said she's gone, eyes dry, smile clean. But grief ain't neat, it's raw and mean. No note, no trace, just a quiet chair. And perfume ghosting and dead still air.
She's fine, he said, but the floorboard cried. Truth's a weight you can't always hide.
Steam on the window, guilt in the glass. Some lies crack slow, some truths outlast. Kelby stood where the silence grew. You can't fake grief to a badge that knew. Thank you, legends, you light up the night. Thank you, supporters, you lift us so high. Mattelstar, Lesosaurus, Maya, Sangeetha. We sing your names, you shine like the sky. Have a great week, we'll meet again. With love and music. Until